it's on. Sorry. This one's on, too.
That's on, too.
Okay.
So we'll do a sound check. So if we could settle and begin the evening, we have a very special evening and morning session with Professor Jan Willis, who is Professor Emerita of Religion at Wesleyan. She was there for over 35 years, right?
Yeah.
35 years. So she's currently a visiting professor at Agnes Scott in Georgia. She lives in the northern part of Atlanta. And she's studied Buddhism in the Vajrayana tradition for over 40 years. And was Lama Yeshe your root teacher? Or yes, her root teacher was Lama Yeshe. And she's written the first book you all know. It's called Dreaming Me, Black, Baptist, and Buddhist, One Woman's Spiritual Journey. She has also written The Diamond Light, An Introduction to Tibetan Buddhist Meditation, Feminine Ground, Essays on Women and Tibet, and she is a regular contributor to Lion's Roar and Shambhala Sun. So we're so honored and pleased to have her join us for two sessions. So thank you and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you all. And
it's been a pleasure to join you this afternoon. Not exactly. Yes, it was a pleasure. It was a pleasure. Though there was suffering as well, and the sharing of those stories is a gift. So I appreciate you letting me take part in that. Really happy to be here and to talk about stories on a slightly lighter way. These are stories that some of you probably know well. I intend tonight to have sort of a mock class in which there is something for you to think about as I go through this presentation. And it's just a question to keep in mind. Well, there are several questions. It's what do life stories in the Tibetan tradition do, and how do they do it? What do they say about the nature of samsara, and about the nature of teachers, and how they ripen students to receive teachings? I thought that would be appropriate at this kind of gathering. But this was before the theme of stories figured so recently and so large in what you're talking about. Though Larry and I had been in touch, I should make that clear. Oh, tikaha, let me begin again. I say tikaha a lot. It's just tikaha. Avkasaha, tikaha. Oh, in Hindi. How are you doing? Doing fine. So it's a pause. Tikaha. It's moving right along, tikaha. I say that a lot, and so I'll just explain it up front. Nothing's wrong, it's just how I'm thinking. And I intersperse that one with awe, which is a Tibetan pause. Just means yes. Again, moving right along. You'll hear me say it a lot, so I might as well explain it up front. Oh. Nagarjuna said, in the Bodhisattva Sambhara Shastra, dharma before personal benefit. This is about how you tell a true bodhisattva. There are four measurements here, or three. A bodhisattva is one who puts dharma before or over personal benefit.
I'm so sorry, but is it possible to get rid of the tone that comes?
What are we doing, raising the volume?
There's a tone when we
talk. Oh, okay. Is it because I'm moving? Is it because this thing is in my lap? Tikaha. Oh, dharma. Dharma over personal benefit. beings over fame in secret. So there's this shloka in which people memorize and try to abide by. And it's just a good reminder to me before I try to give a lecture. Stories. The stories we tell tell a lot about us, as we learned this afternoon. And people have these stories, you know. Shantideva says, Shantideva wrote The Way of Bodhisattva, says, suffering is all of a piece. It's not mine. My separate, isolated self is not yours, so I look away. Suffering is all of a piece. Enough on suffering. I'm going to talk about story. So story is really important in Buddhism, and I'll be talking about it again tomorrow. We talk about the life of the Buddha a little, but I want to say story is so common in all of our different cultures and in our lives. This is a recent copy of a comic book I had on the Buddha's life that's over 45 years old that I bought in Benares, you know, and it keeps being reissued, you know, that perennial never goes out of. The life of the Buddha, and there's the life of Shiva, and the life of poverty, and they're in comic books. People read them when they're young. It tells about who we are as a people, as a culture. So the life of the Buddha, which is told in so many different ways, but it, certainly in Theravada there's one way of talking about it, and then the Mahayanas told it with such expansive, in such an expansive fashion. We don't need them yet. Mark is helping me with the slideshow, which hasn't started yet. But so there's different versions of the Buddha's life in Theravadan tradition. If you look at What the Buddha Taught, which is a book I highly recommend, it's a classic 1959 text called What the Buddha Taught, written by a Singhalese monk who studied with Paul Damiaville for 15 years in Europe, and he studied Mahayana, so he wrote this book called What the Buddha Taught, 99 pages, very succinct, filled with Pali, but very good. And his description of the Buddha's life is the first paragraph of that book, just a paragraph. And the Buddha is depicted very much as a human being who became a great teacher and who gave us this Dharma. But by the time you get to the Mahayana, Maha meaning great, the story had gotten so expansive that it was called just the sport. The activity is just the sport. It's like God's lila, God's play in the universe. It becomes so massive. And that massive way of telling the story had become so popular that even Theravadin started creating expanded lives of the Buddha. No more just the footprints, but an expanded life themselves. And there are different versions of those. So life stories became very, very important. Now, in the Tibetan tradition, they're so important, there's a separate literary genre of them, and they're called, first slide, this. Oh, it's already up. Oh, Namtar. Oh, Namtar. But Namtar, you see those, and it's the first syllable. It's the, in Tibetan, there. Silent affixed and prefixed letters. So it's the first consonant, the first syllable that could be a syllable in this combination of letters. So we put them in capitals. So it's spelled R-N-A, all right, M, but it's pronounced Namtar. Now, the reason I asked Mark to leave that up and then forgot it was up all this time is that it's an abbreviation. Namtar is an abbreviation for Nampa, Tarpa. Tarpa, you may have heard of. There are a number of publishers that call themselves Tarpa publications. Tarpa means liberation. Nam is an intensive particle. It's like Tarpa is moksha, if you know that. And Nampar is Vimoksha, complete liberation, altogether. Vimoksha is Nampar Tarpa. So this genre of literature in the Tibetan is called Namtar for short. It means complete liberation life story. it's not just a biography. It's to show how that person attained liberation, complete liberation. So Namtar are really popular, and they're popular because they indicate how a guru ripens the student to receive teachings. They also give examples and verification that liberation is possible. You have a genre of literature with hundreds and hundreds of Namtar in them. Today, more and more, women's lives are being found as well. But you'll find there's quite a gender imbalance, but that's perhaps for later discussion. Oh. So complete liberation life stories also verify not only that liberation is possible, but that the lineage is pure. That is, the teachings come down from Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, the historical Buddha of this age, all the way directly, directly through your root teacher into you. There has been no break in the lineage. So the next slide, please. Oh, and now I just show you teachers. In the Tibetan tradition, you all will recognize His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Oh, and this is my root guru. Sweet, huh? So sweet. Oh. So look at that mala, if you will. The mala he's wearing, right? You see the cross? God, this is how I get off one story to another. You see the cross. This was in 1983, a year before he passed away. And he died of congestive heart failure. And doctors, Western doctors, Nepalese doctors, Tibetan doctors had been telling him, you have to take it completely easy. You won't live beyond a year. And that he was told that for 12 years. His heart was literally enlarged. Tika! And slowed down. So at this last year, we were having a retreat at Vajrapani in the Santa Cruz Mountains, also mentioned today. And a student of Lama Yeshe, this retreat was for people who had been practicing at least 12 years, and about 80 of us showed up. And it was very special to spend so much time with Lama Yeshe, 3 months there. And one of the student's grandmother came. And she just fell in love with Lama Yeshe, and she said, I want you to have this. And she gave him that wooden cross. And he was just delighted. And he put it immediately onto his mala. And like any lama, he plays with his mala a lot, and he looks happy enough with it. So once my father asked me, I told this story once today, I'm sorry. My father asked me, daughter, do those Buddhists give you a hard time when you say you're a Baptist Buddhist? And I said, no, Daddy, I don't get a hard time from the Buddhist. Oh, not from the Buddhist. I think there's one more of them. Oh, this is one of the last pictures of him. So, I think there's something on the next slide that's in right. Yes, this is where I was explaining the meaning of Namtar. Namparatarpa. Okay, complete liberation. And Gyu. Gyu means lineage, but it also means Tantra. And Tantra refers both to the thread of when you're weaving, the warp and the woof, what you know more about than I do. The thread, it means continuity. There's been continuity from Siddhartha Gautama up to the present day. And it also refers to a group of texts with a capital T, Tantra, which describe meditation techniques. So Namtar describe actually the lives which verify a lineage of a given school of Tibetan Buddhism And they do so by describing the life stories, here again, of beings who attained enlightenment in one lifetime using tantric means, gained enlightenment in this body, in this lifetime, even in these degenerate times. And so Tibetan Tantra is called the speedy path to liberation. And it's called a speedy path with the knowledge that it's also, it can be, a dangerous path. Why might it be dangerous? Because it uses, apparently, or so one from the outside might think, dangerous means. That is, rather than press down, suppress negative emotions. This is really off script, Mark. Sorry, you're being patient. Rather than suppress negative emotions like hatred and desire, one uses the very important term, energy of those emotions. Not those emotions. One taps the energy of those emotions and uses that as a path to enlightenment. This is why it's very important to have a teacher monitoring you. Because otherwise, it could be dangerous for you. You know, like, I'm wrath incarnate. Look out. With no guide, you think it's positive to be angry. You might think so. And more than that, it's dangerous because tantric practice is the second form of Mahayana practice. And that means you're doing it for the benefit of beings, not just self-benefit. So if you aren't successful, then you can't help those beings. That clear? Tika, huh? Okay. So tonight I'm going to talk about, I think next slide, Mark, two people who are on this fourfold list. So there are four on this list. I'm afraid I'm going to do something with this mic. So the lineage of teachings, please tell me if any of this is, I don't know, too wordy or too technical. Doesn't need to be. You know, I'm just talking about teacher to disciple, and that disciple becoming a teacher of the next person in the list, and that person becoming the teacher of the last person in the list. This particular lineage that I'm talking about is a lineage that shows two Indian so-called siddhas. Siddhas are people who've accomplished, using tantric means, accomplished enlightenment in one lifetime. It's also the name of Siddhartha Gautama. That is, his father named him the one who accomplishes his aims. Artha means aim. Siddha means accomplish. He will accomplish it. He has accomplished it. The one who's accomplished his aims is called Siddhartha. Not just in Hermann Hesse's book. So this shows the lineage of the ear-whispered ones, the Kargyus. The Kargyupa school of Tibetan Buddhism. And that school lists the 84 siddhas, but these two are really important Indian siddhas. Tilapa was the teacher of Naropa. I'm going to talk about Naropa's life story tonight. And Naropa was the teacher of Marpa. And then Marpa taught Milarepa. I often teach the life stories of Naropa together with the life story of Milarepa because on the surface of it, they seem so completely opposite in nature. But I hope you'll see by the end that they're not so opposite at all. Tikaha. So you can see when they were living, so 11th and 12th centuries. I'm going to focus on Naropa now and Milarepa. Clear? Clear. I mean, got that? Okay. That's all right? Okay. Thanks. We'll stop after this. Here's a depiction of Naropa. And I just want to point out here The cities are depicted as iconoclastic, you know, they were not monks. Oh, they were people who dabbled with, you know, these horrified Catholics who went to, sorry, but that's true. The British folk who went to Tibet said these folk, and saw Tibetan shrine rooms, they said these folks are really Catholics, but they're corrupt Catholics. Because there was all this ritual, there was painting, they're corrupt. And tantric practitioners were even thought by other Buddhists to be corrupt. Why? Because they touched. Nothing was out of bounds for them. They practiced with the so-called 5 M's, which involve meat, maituna, sexual relations, or meat. All. But it was to question the feigned purity of the environment in which these folk were. So also they were demonstrating an understanding of emptiness. This thing is no more real than that. So what's the difference between gold and excrement? In their nature, both are exactly the same. Tika, and they understood that. So, but the other thing, so they're often, so he has a bone, and he's playing it as a horn, and he's sitting on an animal skin, which purest Buddhists wouldn't have done at the time. But the distinguishing feature of them, and why it's called a speedy path, is this red strap you see around him. And people, last time I was in Nepal, and I haven't been there since the earthquake, so I don't know, but these shops were selling these, and they're called gomtaks. And the gomtak is a meditation strap. It means you're such a fierce meditator, you're not going to sleep, you're not going to stretch out. Rather than do that, you're just going to take that strap. And if you sleep, you're going to be sleeping full lotus. Right? Because you've got a gomtak and you wear it seriously. You meditate seriously. Talk about no difference between ordinary life and meditation. So all siddhas have this gomtak, even if you can't see it under their robes. Oh, so we can stop for a while with pictures, okay? So how many of you have read or heard the story of Naropa? So there's some. There's a university named after him, right, in Boulder. Though people usually say Naropa, right? But it's really a long ah, the first ah, but didn't read. So Naropa, you know it. Okay, what's the thing about Naropa? Well, I don't think I ever pointed out the prompts for what you should be thinking about in terms of the class. I might have said it casually, but one of the questions will be at the end. What was Naropa's main samsaric illness? What was Mila's? How did the teacher treat them in each case? Think about this, okay, as we're going along. So Naropa. Naropa's life story is like the Buddha's in many ways. That is, he was born into a wealthy family. And he was a precocious kid, so precocious that when he was 8, he told his king father and his very beautiful mother, you know, it's the most we women can get, he's beautiful and chaste. What? He's beautiful, chaste, and virtuous, right? At 8, Naropa was so precocious that he announced to his parents one day, I wish now I've mastered all the Buddhist scriptures of Mahayana and all the Theravadins, to say nothing about them. And now it's time for me to go and study a bit more of the tantras. And apparently they said, okay, whatever you want, son. And off he went to a place called Pulihari, which is near Kashmir. And he studied there for 3 years. And then he came home with a group of people trailing behind him, and he announced to his parents, I mastered all the tantras, but I want to go a bit further with these teachers, so please make accommodations for them. He He was 11. Precocious, right? But 11, please make accommodations with him. Okay, son. And when he turned 16, so they built the extra houses, and he continued to study with them. But then when he turned about 16, same as the Buddha, parents started thinking, it's time for him. It's time for us to arrange a suitable marriage for our son, right? Oh, and Naropa wanted no part of that. And when he refused, they said, you know, like, we've gone along with everything you wanted. You know, but you're getting of age. You know, and this is our duty and job. So please allow us to do this. So then Naropa says, well, if she meets all of these criteria, okay, I'll consider marrying her. And he made them what he thought were absolutely impossible characteristics. Beauty being the first, but, you know, it's not, you know, she had to be a certain kind of beauty, like the Buddha's wife, Yashodhara, she a beautiful waistline. Udara, yashas, Udara, Yashodhara. She of gorgeous waistline. She had to have that. Sorry, I do this. In my classes, I get up and walk on the road, so I'm doing well to stay in the chair. No, I'm tethered. So he gave this list, right? And he thought, in all the surrounding kingdoms, no one meeting all these criteria can be found. And the parents said, aha, and they found her. Well, her name is Niguma, which means stainless, right? And also no qualities whatsoever. She's like Bakmema, selflessness, totally pure and empty. They found her. They brought her. You should know that Niguma founded a school of her own. You might have heard of the six yogas of Naropa. There's also the six yogas of Niguma, because later on, she is recognized in the tradition as being an incredible master in her own right. So they find her, and Naropa, I guess he liked her. Oh. So the wedding was performed, and then he said to her, I want no part of this. I want no part of this. No part of domestic life. And she said, whatever you wish. And they were together for a number of years, and then Naropa said, enough of this pretense. I want to leave. And she said, okay, I'll take care of it. I'll tell your parents it's all my fault, and we can annul the marriage. Okay. This is something about Naropa. Naropa always had his mind intent on Dharma. It was a good name for a university. But he was lacking something else. So he convinced Niguma to take the blame for the annulment of the marriage. And then he went on to become abbot, the keeper of the keys, at the world-renowned, in its time, best Buddhist university in all of Jambudvipa, in all of India, and all of Asia, in fact. Folk from China came to Nalanda at that time. And Naropa was abbot. Now I need to read a bit from Naropa's life. There's a translation by Gunta. I think it's a good one. And this is at a time when Naropa was known by the name Abhayakirti. I love it. When you know what the Sanskrit means. Abhaya is fear. Fearless. Abhaya. And Kirti is famed for. So, you know, nothing frightens Naropa. Nothing at all. He is famed for fearlessness. Then one day, once... It's a good pair, and I've been teaching it, and this isn't the first copy. But on page 24 here of Gunther's translation, once when Jigmed Thakpa, that's Abhaya Kirti, he's abbot now of this famed university, once when Jigmed Thakpa, with his back to the sun, was studying the books on grammar, epistemology, spiritual precepts, and logic, presumably all at the same time, a terrifying shadow fell on them. Looking round, he saw behind him an old woman with 37 ugly features. Colon. Here come the 37 ugly features. Her eyes were red and deep hollowed. Her hair was fox-colored and disheveled. Her forehead large and protruding. Her face had many wrinkles and was shriveled up. Her ears were long and lumpy. Her nose was twisted and inflamed. She had a yellow beard streaked with white. Her mouth was distorted and gaping. Her teeth were turned in and decayed. Her tongue made chewing movements and moistened her lips. She made sucking noises and licked her lips. She whistled when she yawned. She was weeping and tears ran down her cheeks. She was shivering and panting for breath. Her complexion was a darkish blue. Her skin rough and thick. Her body bent and askew. Her neck curved. She was humpbacked. And being lame, she supported herself on a stick. She said to Narappa, "What are you looking into?" "Well, I study the books on grammar, epistemology, spiritual precepts, and logic." He's not afraid of anything. "Do you understand them?" "Yes." "Do you understand the words or the sense?" "The words." The old woman was delighted, rocked with laughter, and began to dance, waving her stick in the air. Thinking that she might feel still happier, Narappa added, "I also understand the sense." But then the woman began to weep and tremble, and she threw her stick down. "How is it you felt happy when I said I understood the words, and then were sad when I said I understood the sense as well?" She said, "I was happy because you, a great scholar, did not lie. And then I was sad when you clearly did." "Who then understands the sense?" Narappa, always competitive, always out to get the pith of the Dharma, right? "Somebody knows more than I. Who then? Who then? Tell me." "My brother," she says, "Tilapa." He was first in that list of four. "Tilapa. Then Tilapa. I'll find him." Narappa. So Narappa's story begins. You have all that introduction, and then he's on top of things at Nalanda, and then something catches his attention for the first time in his life. And it says that he may not be as smart as he thinks. And she told him Tilapa, and he goes on a search for Tilapa. And he becomes like an animal with blinders on, because for the next 12 years, he goes looking for Tilapa. Oh, 12 years. He comes upon one, what turns out to be a vision, after the other. Oh, the first is of a leper woman blocking his path. And he looks at her in disgust and says, "Get out of my way, old woman." And she says, "Well, if you have no time at all, if you're in a hurry, I guess you could just jump over me, and if you've got some time, you could walk around, sir." And Narappa pinches his nose and jumps over. He's got no time. He needs to find a guru. He wants to debate him. He wants a challenge. So, of course, when he jumps over her, no, 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 you could hear the music if you made a movie of this. And then there's this voice. And it's someone who is the teacher saying, how will you find a teacher when your heart is totally lacking in compassion? It's totally lacking in it. Oh, and he's sad for a bit, and then he goes on the search. And time again, he misses his opportunity to connect with the teacher. This is quite something to be in amidst this many teachers, future teachers. Oh. Shantideva also says this, just thinking, just for this occasion. We Buddhists say we want enlightenment. And we Mayanists say we want to liberate all beings. And then most of us, in fact, say, except this one, and this one, and this one. How will you ever attain enlightenment? Unless you treasure each of these you meet, because they are your way to enlightenment. There is no way around it. Beings are your way to enlightenment. Without exception, you can't, you know. You'd be all right, but I don't know about you, you know. That won't get you to liberation, picking and choosing. But to transform that thought into how wonderful. So I just wanted to say how wonderful to be with you tonight in this group of future Buddhas. Tika. Oh, so he misses and he misses and he misses finding a teacher. There's a song made in the 80s by a group. The album was called Awakening. Does anybody know that? It was a group of Western nuns at the City of 10,000 Buddhas. They made a recording. They were enrobed. One played steel guitar. One played drums. Enrobed, you know. It was cool. The album was called Awakening, but one of the songs that I thought about just then to try to let you in on that was, one of the songs was, so when if they sang about the Western paradise, they sang it as a country Western song. Way out west in Amitabha's heaven, way out west in Amitabha's land, and then steel guitar just be going in robes. But one of the... Oh, and they also sang a good one about karma. And it was all about, in mid-80s, it was all about how you teach Buddhism without mentioning Buddhist technical terminology. So when they sang about karma and the idea of death is certain, the time is uncertain, and only Dharma will help, they sang a song. And some of my students said, oh, it's like the Bangles. Did anybody ever hear the Bangles? Well, the song was... My body was the cutest thing, gave it the best of everything, plenty of sunshine, plenty of rest. And when it died, it got so big and green, smelled just like an old latrine. All my old friends quit the scene. Who would have guessed it would happen to me? My body, my body. Okay. But... to tie it up, really, what I was thinking was one of their most touching songs was a song about the Buddha, which had as its theme, once in aeons past, he was a criminal more vile than we can conceive of, and he became a Buddha. And it was called Great, Great is the Joy Within My Heart. Tika. If you get that album, it's probably on YouTube or something. It's called Awakening. So Naropa is looking for the teacher, looking for the teacher, looking for the teacher. And he finally, after 12 years of being unsuccessful and hearing these voices, he finally decides that maybe he won't find the teacher in this lifetime, so he decides he's going to take his own life and hope that he will meet the teacher in a future lifetime. At that point, Tilopa says, "What's the matter with you?" Tilopa, who may have been the old woman. She said it was her brother, but, you know, teachers sort of reel you in sometimes. He said, "I was here all along. I've been here all those 12 years. You couldn't see me ever. You kept jumping over me. You kept turning away in disgust. You know, like if you meet Jesus, what do you do?" To mix. Okay. Oh. Baptist Buddha said, okay. Oh. So then, Tilopa says, "Okay, so you want the teachings, do you?" And Narva was going, yeah, I want the teachings, all these 12 years, you know, all I want is the Dharma. And Tilopa says, "Okay." And goes into meditative for over a year. Naropa's jumping around. "Oh, please give me the teaching. I'm here, you know, yeah, please. What are you going to do? Don't meditate. You're going to argue with the teacher. Don't meditate. Teach me. So for over a year, he frustrates Naropa. Then he says, "Okay, if I had a disciple, he'd go to the top of the highest cliff and jump off." Naropa, "Oh, me, it's me, I'll do it." To prove he's a disciple. You watching this story? So that he's now under the instruction of Tilopa. What's he doing? So off goes Naropa, jumps off the cliff. Oh, Naropa strolls by, looks down. Tilopa strolls by, looks at him, says, "What's the matter with you, Naropa?" And Naropa says, "Oh, this body with broken bones, it aches so much." Tilopa goes off. He can't, and Naropa can't find him for another year. And then he finds that he's meditating and he has to wait. And then he comes out of that meditative trance and he says, "If I had a disciple, he'd go down, beat up all those guards around that palanquin and take the queen out and beat her up." And off goes Naropa. It's like donkey. Donkey in Shrek. "Oh, me. You with me? Any donkey?
Yeah.
Eddie Murphy, you know, like, "Oh, it's me." That's how Naropa, he wanted to impress him that he was a disciple, he was worthy. I'll try to speed this up now. So he goes down, the guards whack him near to death, and Tilopa strolls by. "Ah, Naropa, what's the matter with you?" And with a brush of his hand, Naropa's made completely whole and healed again. And this goes on for another 12 years. And at the end of the second 12 years, Tilopa asks him, and he is able to say it. You know Marie Cardinal's, the words to say it? Oh, that's a novel worth reading. He says there's something that he lacks. So desirous is he of the prize, which is Dharma, he's forgotten beings. Tilopa then says, "Ha, I thought it was ready. It's time to do something. You want the teachings?" "Yeah, here they are." And it's described as the experience of water being poured into water. So easy, so simple. And that Naropa, then he's fully enlightened. He practices the teachings, and he becomes fully enlightened. And then he has a dream, and in the dream he sees someone coming, and it's going to be someone with a caravan and animals and all this stuff, and that was Marpa. And Marpa is called Marpa the Translator. He was one of the early Tibetans to make 3 trips to India, lots of hardship. And Marpa studies with Narappa. And Marpa then later teaches Mila Tika. Next slide. Oh, Mila. Next slide, please. Here's 2 Milas side by side. On this one, you can see the painters tried to capture what is famous. One of the famous elements of Milarepa is that he's green in color. And that's by virtue of having survived by eating only nettles, that his body turned gray-green. It was much worse than this. And the skeleton and all this. So just that image. I'm going to talk about it later. Maybe you can see this. This is a magnet from my refrigerator. He's really green on this one. And you see in both, he's wearing that gomtak. Milarepa is known for lots of reasons. He, as an example of how important stories are, all Tibetans learn to read. They can learn ritual devotional songs just by hearing them. They learn to read by reading the life of Milarepa, by, that is, putting what they've heard into visual, into the letters of the alphabet. They learn to read with the life of Milarepa because every child has heard the life of Milarepa. Why is it so famous? For a number of reasons. Milarepa demonstrates that a person can commit as much bad karma as imaginable and still attain enlightenment in that very same life. Because Milarepa actually kills 35 people at the urging of his mother, it should be said. Oh. So you see the gum talk, you see his color. He's on the animal hide there. I want you to pay special attention. Most people don't. Nobody talks about them, so they talk about the iconography of Mila. But you see in both of these, this one is sort of hidden. And in that one, you see there's a little white thing there. That's a scroll, and it's very important. That'll come up in the story. And I'll try to tell this story briefly. The story of Mila. The first thing that's noticeable about it, and there are different translations. There was a recent one by Andrew Quinton, a young scholar at Yale. Andy, this is much easier to read. My students like it. They don't get so stuck on the Tibetan names. It doesn't have a long introduction like Lalumpas, which I think Lalumpas translation, this one. Losang Lalumpas, which is much earlier, but has a lengthy introduction, which probably talks too much about 3 kayas of the Buddha and all of this, but I think his translation is gorgeous. So there, both of these are available, and Evans Wentz in 1927, lots of people translate the life of Mila. But it's because the life itself is so amazing, and first off, it's told in the first person. We immediately want to become close with Mila. Because you see, his disciples have been saying, you know, you're our master, you've taught us everything we know, but we'd like to know more about what brought you here. And you see this happen a number of times in the text, and then Mila says, okay, and you know, out of compassion and kindness, okay, I'll tell you. So it's first person, whereas if I didn't mention, I probably didn't. Narappa is told in the third person, as is most Buddhists. Life story. Third person, you know, it's all about he did this and he did that. But Mila is always saying, I. So there's this bond, I think. There's this affinity created from the beginning. So Milarepa means, clothed in Tibetan. And Mila is a kind of cotton, kind of Indian khadi. And he's famous because he just wore cotton. He was cotton clad in the snow Himalayas. All he ever wore was this thin cotton cloth. One of the reasons for that is because he practiced Naropa, six yogas, the first of which is known as Dumo heat. Dumo heat, which creates fire, and you know, you don't want to have on much. But he lived in caves in the Himalayas in the snow in Tibet. Tigar. So his name is that. But his given name was Terpaka. That doesn't sound too great. But it means he loves to sing. So sweet, he loves to sing. Now, the other reason Milarepa is famous is for the 100,000 songs of Milarepa. Later in life, when he was an enlightened master, people would come up to the caves and talk about being outraged by his appearance, his gray-green nettle skin, fuzzy, bones poking out. And Mila says, my physical appearance doesn't match at all my mind. And it didn't, but he sang songs to them, songs of enlightenment. So there's the 100,000 songs of Milarepa. And as a child, he was given the name, he loves to sing. So Mila's turning point comes when he was born into a well-to-do family, but his father died when he was 7. And just before his death, he calls his brother and his sister-in-law and says, I'm going to entrust my family's fortune to you to hold for my son until he becomes of age. Oh. So the intrigue of this story is that when Mila's father dies, the family reneges on that. They make Mila, his sister, and his mother their slaves. They take over the house. They empty out the house. They put some of their servants in their house. They give them a little patch of land on which they're supposed to provide food for them, for themselves, because they get no funding from. And it's their money, right? So we see this picture of a mother who is just becoming consumed with vengefulness. And so this is what happens in Mila's story. Mila, as a teenager, gets a job. He tries to bring in support for the family. He has a job with this person. And early on in the story, he says, when the disciples say, how did it come to be that you committed such negative karma? Mila tells the story that one day he accompanied this person he was working for to a party they had been invited to. And Mila says, drinking much beer, much chung, you know, Tibetan chung, not only what I poured for him, but also what all the others poured for him, my tutor became drunk. He sent me ahead with the presents he had received. I also was drunk. Hearing the singers, I too had a desire to sing, and having a good voice, I sang as I went along. The road passed in front of my house, and I was still singing. When I arrived at the front of our door. In the house, my mother was roasting barley, and she heard me. What is this? She said to herself. That sounds like the voice of my son. But how could he be singing while we are so miserable? And then the rest. And not believing what she heard, she looked outside. As soon as she recognized me, she cried out in surprise. Her right hand dropped the tongs. Her left hand dropped the whisk. And leaving the barley to burn, she took a stick in one hand and a handful of ashes in the other. She ran down the big steps, leapt over the little ones, and was outside. She threw the ashes in my face, struck me several times on the head, and shouted, Father, Mila Banner of Wisdom, Mila's father, is this the son you have begotten? He is not worthy of you. Look at our fate, mother and son. And with this, she fainted. So Mila, the one time he was happy in public, she overheard. And she came, and as only, you know, probably we may all have this in our lifetimes, but and I think it must be very hard to be a parent. I don't know. Oh. But you can do something in a split second and that child feels it, you know. Oh, so threw the ashes in his face, said, "This son is not worthy of you." Okay. Mila then says, "I determined then and there, whatever she said, I do." So she said, "The only way you can help is to get revenge on your uncle and aunt. Go learn black magic and do it. If you don't," this was quite a curse, it's all here. "If you don't succeed in revenge and revenge down through 9 generations of their family, I will kill myself in front of your eyes," he says. So Mila goes away kind of heavy-hearted. There's fun in the story, some humor. About to bring it to a close. Mila studies with a magician, and you see him trying to make a hailstorm, and he's meditating. And there's this little puff of cloud. And he tries some more. And clouds got bigger and bigger. Until he had success, siddha, with this practice. He gained some realization with that practice. He went back to the village, and from some distance off, he meditated and caused this great hailstorm. People who survived it said they saw the columns become giant scorpions. They saw the horses turn into monsters. They saw oxen put their heads down and knock the posts that held the house up where the party was taking place, and it collapsed in on them, and 35 people died. 35 people died. Then, what happens? We don't hear much about the mother. She's scorned for the rest of her life there. And Mila says to his disciples, If I went out, I wanted to stay in. If I stayed in, I wanted to go out. Sleep escaped me. I couldn't eat. Constantly I wondered, how can I find a Dharma teacher, a genuine Dharma teacher? How can I do anything about these karma hordes that are licking at my every move there? He felt it. He knew that the minute 35 people were killed, no matter why he'd done it, the karma would be his. The results would be his to reap. And so he felt right away the karma hordes licking at his feet. So with this kind of pain and this kind of intensity, because there's something that's quite desperate about these siddhas, what's going to lead you to attain enlightenment in one lifetime? What is it going to take? What kind of grit, determination, and desperation is it going to take? Mila was at that point. And when he finds one teacher who says, you might want to stand up for a while if you're tired. This was supposed to be sort of give you a little lightness. But if you need to stretch, you can. Okay. If you're going to stay in the room, though, I'll keep talking. Shall I? Okay. So Mila goes on the search because he knows he's going to have to pay for what he's done, the negative deeds. And he meets with a teacher who says, "Yeah, I have a special teaching, and it will help. No doubt." Mila then, what do you expect Mila did? This is like, we all know this. Mila fell asleep. Right? You ever been under so much pressure? The first time you think you get a little help, you let down. You just, you know, help at last. Praise the Lord. Mila fell asleep. And he had always been a worker. Right? That was proof, Miller tells his disciples, that teacher could not help him. That teacher who said, oh yes, I have a teaching, it will help you in a jig's time. That couldn't help a personality like Miller. So Miller, that teacher finally realizes and sends Miller on his way. Miller comes across a guy plowing a field. That's Marpa. And he says to the person plowing, have you ever heard of this guy Marpa? I'm looking for him. And Marpa, knowing that that's who he's been waiting for and he's dreamt of him too, he says, I think if you go over this mountain and that mountain, you know, and maybe in 2 days' walk you'll meet him. And he says, but while you're here, Marpa says to Miller, while you're here, plow my field. I'm going to go have a drink. Marpa is the eccentric siddha himself, right? Not a monk. Householder. Lots of women in the house, though he has one wife. Drinks a lot. Miller says, okay. Plows his field. And if you think about the story of Miller, Miller is always doing that. Miller, you'd say, is kind-hearted. He's sweet. Miller wants to please. And he does what others say. That's a theme in Miller. Oh, I call him Miller because he speaks in the first person. I feel so close to him, you know. He felt like, these karma hordes, you know. I'm never going to get out of this trouble, you know. So 2 days later, he finds Marpa. He realizes that's the same person who came. And Marpa says, yeah, I have some teaching, but, you know, you don't look like you have much wealth. Because, you know, you make offerings to a teacher. You make offerings, you know. You get the bowl, and you put the little gold in there, and you put a little turquoise in there, and you wrap it all with a cup, all nice, in the Tibetan tradition. You know, an offering. Miller had a little broken food bowl, you know. Nothing. Nothing to offer. He said, all I've got is me, but you'll have all of that. Teacher says, okay, I'll take you home. Right? And that teacher, Marpa's wife, is named Dak Me Ma. Dak is I, self. Me Ma is none. Dak Me Ma, non-self. That's really her name, Dak Me Ma. And she's a renowned tantric practitioner also. You can learn in the life of Marpa that when his own son died and Miller's holding his brains and trying to put him back in the skull and take him home, because Marpa had children on his place, and he was training them all, and his favorite son he was training to become the next master. And one day that son had an accident, fell off a horse in the stream, and Miller picked him up and carried him home. And Marpa became hysterical. You learn this in the life of Marpa, not in the life of Miller. Marpa became, he lost it. He's screaming in the house. And you see Dakmema go over to the boy, her eldest son, and cradle him. And his brains are falling out. Very descriptive. And she says to him, she whispers in his ear, remember the practice I taught you? Do that now. Oh, it's fabulous. Namtar are great. Oh, tikaha. So Miller's fame thing, the 12 years, is Marpa has him build towers. It's called the Ordeal of the Towers. Marpa says, I have the teachings, but I'll give them to you when you do what I ask. Just build a tower. I want it right over there. You know, 15 feet. And even though there are all these people who live on Marpa's place, the rule was not a single person can help you. So Miller carries boulders on his back, you know, all comes all blistered, and he builds a tower. Then Marpa strolls along after a year or so and says, who told you to put it there? And Miller's going like, you did. No. And Marpa says, take it down and move it over there. And Miller builds 12 towers. Until one day, Marpa comes and says, hoot. And Miller says, look, you're not going to give me the teachings? Fine. You said if I built the towers, you'd give me the teachings. If you're not, just say that. I'm on my way. Marpa says, you want the teachings? Miller says, darn tootin'. Marpa says, oh, okay. And like pouring water into water, there it is. And Miller decides he's going to go to caves in the Snowy Mountains and practice what the teachers taught him. He becomes enlightened in that life, and he sings the 100,000 songs. Marpa loved him immensely, and he says as much to the wife who had tried to sneakily help Miller out when Marpa was seemingly being so cruel. She gave him money. She said, take it to this teacher over there. Ask for the teachings. It doesn't seem like my husband's going to give them to you. Marpa berates her something fierce. All right. I'll just tell you. Want to know what Marpa says? He says, with every one of those towers, massive amounts of negative karma he was erasing. This lifetime. Not future lifetime. And I had him erase it all except this last till your intervention. He says, oh, is that true? Is it not? This talk is also to point out distinctive features of tantric practice, how a teacher ripens a student. That's part of that name, right? And the last thing I want to say is that little scroll is the only thing Marpa gave Miller. As he hugged him and cried and cried and cried when Miller said he was going to go and practice in the cave, he said, okay, son, because he'd become more of a son to him than all of Marpa's sons. He said, here's this, take this. This is my heart advice to you, heart advice. Don't open it until you're at the point of death. You know, you're so close, you're so bereft. Then open this advice. Okay, and so Miller walks off and pins that in his cave. I can tell you afterwards what the note said, but Marpa loved him. Okay, so there are these two life stories. What do I have on there afterwards? Let's see. I don't know.
Comparison.
Tika ha. Hey. All right. These are some of the things I've tried to point out on the way. Namely, third person narrative, as opposed to Naropa's is, as opposed to Miller's. Well-to-do versus poor, precocious. I say normal, whatever that is. I know that normal. Likes to sing. Naropa is driven to learn, but Miller strives to please, whether it was the person he worked for, or his mother, or Marpa in the field. These are real, I think, opposites, but they're also clear. Clearly, they seem to be 180 degrees. Naropa tries to figure out how to trick his parents, you know, about the marriage, and so forth, whereas Miller seems never to have a thought like, how would I do this? He's just, he's even-keeled, he wants to please. Oh. Then I talk about the ordeal, it's 12 years and 12 years, and it's another 12 for Nara because he was really tough. Hard nut to crack. All right, now, here's a question for you. I'm done with the comparisons. The question is, what is Narapa's main samsaric problem? What is Miller's? And how does the guru cure it? All right, you teachers, what would you do? You got a character like Narpa. You think I need a teacher? As students have come to me at Wesleyan. You know where I was last summer? I was at Gombo Abbey. I said, I'm sorry, you still need to take intro. You need to take intro, I'm sorry. You can't just jump into Tibetan. You need to take intro. Oh,
What is military? So how does the guru treat them? Oh, I give it away here with this building conference. Oh, tikaha. That part we should have cut out, the bottom part. So, but what do you think is their problem? And is it any different than us? And how would you characterize it? All right. I know these are simple questions in a way. But having just heard the stories, maybe not have read them, some of you have read them, how would you characterize Naropa's main problem? What's his biggest issue? I hear a lot of different sounding things. They may be the same thing, you know? They may be the same thing. I heard what? Striving, determined, okay? And then I heard prideful, impatience, arrogance, lack of compassion, what? Clinging, thinking, clinging. I missed it, but I think that's right. Yeah. All of those things. If you had to say self, if you wrote S-E-L-F and hyphen, how would you finish it? About Naropa. Self-centered. Self-focused. What? Self-absorbed. Selfish. Some people say, he's so full of himself, full of self. He is. In the Tibetan tradition, they also describe, they also assign psychological states to these two. The hermeneutics of the genre says, Naropa is in the God realm of samsara, though, you know. All six of those realms, I have to remind people, are in samsara. You know, it's all held in the grip of Yama, Lord of Death, right? Where are the Buddhas on those images in the Tibetan paintings? Up here, outside the wheel. Oh, Matthew, is that funny? Okay, this was funny, right? Okay. All right. So even though your Naropa is in the God realms, you know, oh, I'm so fine, look up here. You know, your lifespan is incalculable, right? You don't see an end in sight. You'll still, one day, your death will happen too. Even if you're a god, it will happen. You notice your skin starts wrinkling. Your clothes start getting faded color. I was just reading a description of this. What happens in the God realms when your time's up in the God realm? You perspire for the first time. You lose your delicate fragrance. And then you know that it's approaching the end of this realm. And they say of Mila, he's an animal realm. I don't know. This Tibetan hermeneutic says Mila's sort of like in the animal realm. I think they're just taking off from the one time he falls asleep, you know, that the idea of being animals are after food. Some Tibetans don't really treat them like we maybe think of them. I mean, Tibetans have great pets, but they think animals are, they're about food and sleep. Mila's doing something else. Okay, same thing for Mila. What's Mila saying? So do we cover all of Naropa? Mm-hmm. Pretty much. All those kinds of things, you know, that full of self makes you like arrogant, impatient, self-cherishing, selfish, not thinking of others. You know, how could you think of others? I'm focused on me. I'm the, you know, hey, Jan Willis here. Whew, smelling good. Oh, no. Tigger, huh? And Miller. What's Miller's main samsaric problem? That is, what ties him in the samsara? Yes.
When you pointed us to selfish,
mm-hmm.
selfless arose for me, formula, in the uh-huh. suffering by all of this giving. There's so much generosity that he's not seeing that he's being fooled and being fooled.
Oh, okay. You think he's selfless?
That's what, just that language arose as a
mm-hmm.
opposite to the language for the
uh-huh.
not the no self.
That's really sweet. That's really sweet. That's kind, you know. You know, sweet Miller. He means, my teacher would say, he means well, dear. He means well. He did. He means well. Miller meant well. He wanted to please. When people want to, I find, I'll say personally, when I want to please, it's because I'm not feeling so good. Right? So what are some other adjectives from Miller?
Regret.
Negative
karma.
Yeah, well, this all happened. So this happens before the turning point. What's it like even before?
Kind of like enabling.
Enabling. Uh-huh. Yeah, he wants to help everybody get what they want. Yeah. Uh-huh. All right, all those things. He is fearful all the time. He has, if Naropa's self-esteem is out of the roof, then Miller has none. And when you have low self-esteem, I find a habit develops of wanting to please, right? Even when you feel bad, you want to please because you want somebody love you up, or to just love you once. Miller. Other adjectives? He's fearful. He's, well, okay. He's kind-hearted. He's a sweetheart. You know? You want him to stand up for himself sometimes, and that he doesn't have. He doesn't have till he's built 12 towers. Because Marpa knew this person needed some confidence. Tiga. Now, one personal story. So I get to Lama Yeshe, right? And I know about the people saying you're not worth anything. So I got low self-esteem. I go pulling in there with. Huh. So Lama Yeshe looks at me one day with his toothbrush and his towel. I'm just chilling. Just got there. I've done this whole thing with Lama Yeshe. I was with two other friends. The three of us met him together, and they're just blown over. And they say, oh, he's so compassionate. And I say, Tibetans are all compassionate. Why do I want to make light of something I need? You know, but I know. I say, all of them are compassionate. Don't get swept away. And then I said, I'm looking for the wisdom being myself. I'll just let you know. I thought I was an idiot. You know, I was young. I've grown a bit since then. Oh. So even with Lama Yeshe, I had this judging mind, because that kind of judgment is also low self-esteem, feeling inferior, you know, blah, blah, blah. So one day, Lama Yeshe is on his way to brush his teeth, and I'm sitting there, and he looks at me, and he goes, yes, daughter. I'm going, yeah, what? You know, because I'm trying not to be so impressed. He says, pride and humility, be conflict, huh? And went on to brush his teeth. And I thought, he put his finger on it, you know, because what I wanted to do would be a good human being with humility. That's what I wanted. He went on brush his teeth. Tiga. It was so simple. He diagnosed my problem. And the problem was such a low self-esteem. So this is how he treated me. So one day we're having some conversation, and he said, blah, 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 blah. To which I said, blah, 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 blah. And he said, wow. He said, wow. I say one thing, you say five. To which I responded, Loma, is that bad? Because I knew it must be bad if it's coming out of me, right? And he said, no, no. It means you're quick, your mind quick. He said, huh? Thereafter, over the 15 years I knew him, when other people didn't know what was going on, if we'd be strolling along, we could be going for ice cream. What conversation was, you know? And we, you know, if it turned out to be deep or philosophical or something, and we're having a conversation, Lama would just do this. Just to me. It was just a message to me, like five. I say one thing, you know five. Right? So sweet. We could use that, right? Tika. So if you put self by Miller hyphen, what would you add as an adjective? Self what? Pardon? Self-effacing. Self-abnegation. Self-hate. Self-loathing. What?
Doubt.
Self-pitying. They seem so opposite one another, but what's their main problem?
Self!
So simple. Not really a quiz. Self. It's going to be the problem. It's going to be everybody's problem coming at you. Self. And what they're doing, what the adjective is that comes after that. And the suffering is of a piece. Like Pliny said, 5th century, Greek, be kind. Why? Because everyone you meet is carrying some great burden. It wasn't even Buddhist. Right? It's just universal, you know? So self is the problem. So what does the guru do, the Tibetan teacher? He ripens the student. He gets that. If you need building up, he builds you up. If you need shock treatment like Naropa, what the heck is the matter with you, Naropa? You have to be able to supply the shock treatment. Compassionately. Doesn't seem so compassionate in this story. But it's clearly what Naropa needed. And because then it was like water into water. And it was the spawning of a whole tradition of meditative practice in Tibet. And this lineage and these stories, whenever a teacher begins a teaching, that teacher will invariably tell you a number of Namtar. And it will come down to the teacher, his teacher, her teacher, just before you get this teaching. This teaching comes through someone. And it's very important that those stories be told. And we all have them. Because we're all human, this lifetime. Tikaha. I think I'm done for now. There may be questions or comments. I think we go till 9. I don't know what time it is, though. It's 8:29. Yes. I see, you're Phoenix and you're Krista? Kristen? I don't know which one of you were first, so I don't know how you... Somebody has a question or a comment.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, first of all. Exquisite. So two things. First, I've always loved the story of Milarepa and sort of decided it actually sealed my love of the Dharma was learning about Milarepa because I couldn't identify with a Buddha, because I couldn't identify with the sort of the one who had so much and then renounced it all for the benefit of others, I identified with the baggage that Milarepa had and that Milarepa was working with. So much difficulty, had a complicated past. The piece that you've shifted for me is, and I remember Marpa being so pained by what he put Milarepa through. Mm-hmm. And the piece that I'm working with now is that I had always understood Milarepa's problem as the damage that he had done. Mm. Not that he needed his confidence built, but that he needed to work off that negative karma. Because Marpa seemed to be hurting. I mean, I remember stories of Milarepa's back being broken and just being so, you know, after the 12th time the tower was being built and rebuilt. So is that explicit there, and I just missed it, that it was this self-doubt and the lack of esteem that Milarepa was wrestling with, and not the confused harm that he had done?
I think that it's there in the story.
Yeah.
And Marpa's role is made explicit in the conversation between Marpa and Doc Mema. And it also, Namtar also give, which is what, in 1995 I translated a group of Namtar from the Gelug school, it's called Enlightened Beings, and it's six contiguous lives, right? From Tsongkhapa through the first Panchen Lama of Tibet. It's those two things that you mentioned, he built his confidence, and he helped him work off his negative karma. And he loved him to bits. He wanted him to be stronger. He wanted so badly for Miller to have some spunk that it always made him cry to see Miller was so willing to do whatever he said. Move it. Move it. Move it. Move it. 12 years of that. And he would just go and cry to Doc Mema. You know, his patience seems unending. You know, he just wanted him to fight him.
Yeah, I remember that being so moved by that, that he would have this sort of duplicitous nature with him. He would be so hard on him and then say to his wife, you know, this is killing me to hurt him so, but it's what he needs.
And it's one of, to me, just additional to what you say, is that it's incredible that it's dangled out there that a teacher can help your karma ripen on you now. This is one of the distinctive features about Tibetan Buddhism. It says, well, for all of us, and I really mean that, a guru's blessing is how we traverse the path. So to make that connection and to have someone looking out for us and praying for us gives us that blessing as well as that inspiration, right? But Marpa claims, as he's berating Doc Mema, that I've helped him, you know, he killed 35 people. I've had all that ripen just through sores on his back. Come on, he can take it, right? Would that someone could have our negative karma from aeons ripen on us now. And then we get past it. So I heard it. I'm sorry. I heard His Holiness on an NBC morning show once where the commentator was saying to His Holiness there in a chair, you know, double up and got his little socks and shoes on there, and yogically. And the commentator says, so you really think that good will triumph over evil? It will. And His Holiness says, absolutely. Absolutely. There will come a time when all the negative karma that all beings have created will end and just positive will be there. Well, I thought, that's a nice faith to have. Oh, but he has it, absolutely. So Marpa says, yeah, he has this negative karma, but but I can do something with that. And that's why it's a speedy path. In addition to the effort has to come from the disciple side, there's this tremendous amount of blessing that comes from your connecting with a person who you see as the Buddha. There's tremendous power in that. Thank you, Christine.
Thank you. I really appreciated Milopa's story, but I still have a real hard time with Naropa. I just couldn't get how someone self-centered would do as much as he did. Like, I don't get that.
I don't think I made it very clear. It's better in the story itself, I think that's true. That he slowly comes to see that there is a lack in him, and he's suffering as a result of it. He has to be able to articulate that. And then he puts his finger on what must be lacking. He doesn't ever doubt his intelligence, but he comes to see that there is some benefit in caring for others.
Oh, what I didn't understand is how he, because he's so arrogant, that why a teacher would tell him jump off a cliff and he would just do it. Like, it's easier to understand Milopa
doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but it's like they both kind of did the same thing. They put themselves through all this self-pain where, you know, the history of Naropa, even with his wife, with his parents, was, I don't care what you say. And so...
What causes compassion to arise in him?
Well, before the compassion can arise in him, you have someone who's willing to do anything for the teaching. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's the part that I don't get, is why he was so willing to do anything for the teaching, because he's been so arrogant up till then. So
you're saying those two don't seem to go together?
Yeah.
An interest in Dharma and being so arrogant.
Well, a willingness to jump off a cliff, yeah, that part, yeah.
Well, if desire fuels is the energy for our being in samsara, he clearly is someone who desires something. And he feels that what he lacks is a certain amount of dharmic knowledge, of philosophy. There's some science of learning out there that this one person knows more about than he does. So it's arrogance and that sort of wanting more intellectual validation. That's what he's really after. But he has to come to see, and I think it's there in the story, though not as plain as in Miller's, that he comes to see that it's not all worth it just knowing, say, the words of the scriptures. People are important too. He has to come to see that benefiting beings is as important as being abbot of Nalanda or besting Tilopa in a debate.
Is that because he suffers so much he has compassion for himself?
Yes, he does at a certain point realize that his body is suffering needlessly as well. But he's also had these other encounters with beings. And actually, the first point of selflessness for him is when he's going to commit suicide. That's symbolically something about his story. When he gets to the point where he'll give up himself, that's when Tilopa appears, right? Mm. But it also means he lessened his clinging to self. He was willing to give it up and wait till the next lifetime. And both these stories also show that you can start out with sort of what seems to be a positive goal, and you still be messed up. You know, you still need help. Oh, I don't know. But
thank you.
My pleasure, Phoenix. Yes. Oh, sorry, I saw you first.
Just learned a lot from that. It was beautiful the way you told the story.
Thank you. I was so pitiful. One more story.
Bring it on.
And I judged Lama Yeshe. So one day he took me away from the three and he said, you go stay with my teacher. And I said, aha, the wisdom being that's where I should be. But I felt like, whoa, because I really loved him. I wanted him, you know. So he said, you go study with my teacher. He's known for wisdom. And he said, Lama Yeshe just had me like a book, you know. He's known for the wisdom thing. He's really big on this wisdom. He teaches His Holiness. Geshe Rabdam. I went, I saw it. All right, then later, the three of us, so then I felt kicked out, you know, abandoned by my teacher, whom I just wanted his love, you know, and he said, oh, go, you go to India. He said all these things that seemed to be building me up, like, you speak Hindi, you can get along, you know, you go, you can travel there, and blah, blah, blah. Sent me to his teacher. So both those things, pride and humility, they were just battling in me, right? The long train ride, you know. And I'm going, they're still with him, you know, and I got to go off and meet Geshe Rabdam. Anyway, I went off and met Geshe Rabdam. These turn out to be two stories. Going back, Geshe Rabdam met me fiercely, because I had stopped off. I saw a friend in Benares, stopped off, got there a day late, but I didn't know he knew. Geshe Rabdam knew. I get there, and I'm being introduced, and Geshe Rabdam says, no. I thought, gee whiz, but maybe that means he's the wisdom man. Oh. All right, studied with Geshe Rabdam 6 weeks. Went back, get to about this far, the Lama Yeshe's in there. I see my two friends' shoes outside the door. You know, they've been with him this whole time. So I go in. And I start to bow. Lama Yeshe, my friends wondered what was happening. Lama Yeshe said to me, just like Geshe Rabdam. I was starting to prostrate. I just fell on over, sobbing, you know. I said, please hold me, dear, will you? Don't judge gurus like that, you know? Like, they know what you're up to, you know? You know, just exactly like Geshe Rabdam had. It was like that telekinesis, you know, had gone on between them. Tigaha, that's another story. Oh, that's enough. I'm so glad. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I'm so pitiful. They gave Geshe Rabdam, that same Geshe Rabdam, gave me the name Joy of the Dharma. And then I'm so determined that the other two stood up after the hour and a half, 2 hour ceremony. But you're supposed to ask for it on one knee. So I saw him stand up. Geshe Rabdam had said clear as day, when this gets to be too much, sit down, be comfortable. I'm too stubborn. Man, I'm taking refuge, I'm getting a new name and all that. I'm staying on one knee. So I couldn't get up after the ceremony. I'm like this. This is like it's going to be permanently that way. The Tibetans had a field day. What a great name she has. Look at all the joy she's causing. Could not stand up. Stubborn. Tigaha. Thank you.
Hi. I've got a question, I guess. I was in Vajrayana tradition for about 20 years, mostly in Nyingma tradition and did Nundro and all this stuff. And I'm kind of in a space now where I hear these kind of stories and it feels like almost like Tibetan nostalgia, insofar as I totally believe that was true at the time, and I have a good sense of who Lama Yeshe was and Geshe Rabdam, and those are great teachers who came out of Tibet. You know, I know that. But now in 2016, you know, to when you when someone say, oh, in order to tradition, you need a guru and go find one. It's like, I honestly don't have much faith. There's persons around in 2016 you could have that kind of relationship you talked about there, or even the kind of relationship you described. And so, you know, that's quite frankly, that's a lot of why I poured it over to Vipassana, because I sort of, I was having trust issues, and here we're kind of collective, you know, and there is a sense of movement, but it's really transparent, and we're sort of all peers in a way. I mean, teachers and everybody.
Yeah.
So I kind of wondered if you could, since you're here in this gathering, if there's any way you could relate what you've just been talking about to this reality of this circle, because it's a whole different world, and you know, how those two interconnect in your own heart.
Well, I'd like to say that what I see here is necessary, like Sangha, you know, community. And at the same time, I think there's nothing that compares with the kind of relationship you can have just by seeing another person who inspires you so much. There's nothing like that, I don't think. And I think those people are still available. We still have access to them. Somebody says we have access to 98% of all the Buddhist traditions in the world. And that's just in LA. That was from Buddhism in America course. People do talk like that about LA. But certainly in America, 98% of all Buddhist traditions, teachers, living teachers, are available in this one geographic space. Never been that way in 2,600 years. So it's still possible to meet teachers. Very few, I think, Westerners want to commit the kind of time it would take, especially to do one of these traditions, like a Tibetan tradition. Though there are Tibetans who are here and who take just a few students, maybe, you know, 20, maybe 30, who are going to commit to a few years. And there are such sangha still here. So I'm answering you with a lot of responses. I think sangha is this community. Community is important. There were just the two refuges when the Buddha was alive, right? So you can get the teaching, you get community, and you have people who care about the Dharma. And that can't be beat. And teachers are still accessible. And sometimes we have we want to shop around before we stick long enough to see whether it makes any change in us, I think. So I think it's important, some investment of time, to like we can look back and say, I guess I'm a little less angry behind the wheel. All right, it's green. It's green. Come on. That's my worst thing. It's one of my bad things is in a car. But it just is. I mean, you know. I don't think those stories are of the past. Might have to put forth a little effort and commit a little time. And I think it's important to find a method of meditation that works for us. And that can be different at different times in our lives. And knowing that is good too.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Justin. Thanks for your talk. So in terms of teaching techniques, it seems like Tilopa and Marpa had some pretty intense teaching techniques.
Yes.
Here we are in a teacher training course. You also described your teacher got angry at you as a way to teach.
No. This is important. You get the distinction here. Geshe Robson was angry at me. And Lama Yeshe feigned it to show me that I was judging him. And I was doing this thing. I was comparing him and his teacher, Geshe Repton.
Okay.
And Lama Yeshe was letting me know he knew that I was comparing them. But the thing about Lama Yeshe is, for me, was that in addition to this, he never said a harsh word to me. Over 15 years, he was always about building me up. I took him to an Angela Davis talk. Everyone should be strong, strong, like this woman. Like this one, you, he pointed me, be strong like this woman. Like this woman. That was Lama Yeshe. But I've talked to, some of you may know, I don't know, she does prison work a lot. Her name is Robina. She's a Tibetan, she's an Australian Tibetan nun. Oh, she does a lot of prison work. So Robina once said to me, you know, I'm amazed, she was reading Dreaming Me, and she says, "Oh, this book is not about Jan, it's about Lama Yeshe," which is what the editors had said, don't be overly devotional. So I didn't know it was all, Lama Yeshe came through so much. This is Lama Yeshe and me in Madison in 1974, I think, yeah. And on Lama Yeshe's first trip here, and I had a little more hair then. But not as much as I had, anyway. So Robina had just given a talk when I walked into Seiching Ling in San Francisco. And she said to me, "It's so amazing. Lama Yeshe was so kind to you." She said, "He never said a kind word to me, ever." She said this, and then she said, "It was just what I needed." I can't imagine Lama Yeshe never saying a kind word to her. I can't imagine that.
So I wonder, do you have advice for us as teachers about using any of these techniques to ripen our students? How does this apply to Vipassana in the West? Because my experience is that any sort of technique that uses harsh language is often...
I didn't say use harsh language.
I'm
showing you stories to say, even though they seem to be diametrically opposed, it's all about self and clinging and self-cherishing and, you know, use your patience, be a teacher.
Thank you.
It's simple. I mean, that part is simple. I mean, everybody's coming with the same problem, ultimately. Ultimately, it's the same problem. You know, our minds spin around one thing, self, 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 whether it's self-pity or, you know, selfishness. It's still self. It's still me, I. You know, it's still Piaget, you know, from the moment there, you know, that, you know, you belong to me. From the moment there's I, there's me and mine. That's for everybody, I think. I think the same problem.
I agree.
I'm sure you'll be fine. I think you have good teachers. Jean's got the mic. We have one time.
Thank you.
One more.
Thank you so much. Perhaps the most direct question that I can have is something that I don't know that much is about the Tibetan tradition, but it seems like the role of equanimity is very important. So if you can talk a little bit more about that in the teacher. Role of equanimity.
Yes, okay. My talk tomorrow is really about, I think, hopefully, equality, or Dharma and activism, kind of. I don't know, this feels disingenuous. What I was going to say was this platitude. So I'll see if I can say it honestly. I think the same wisdom that really sees all beings equally, that's a source of compassion. One, because all beings suffer exactly the same way, and with, and I don't mean to, you know, no comparative privileging one over the other, being suffer. That's the point. Senator Davis said, that's the point. Suffering's all of a piece. Enlightenment is about eliminating being suffering. And I think, so I think if you can see all beings as equal, and that's the weighty issue, what does that mean and how does that affect you? I think if you can get to the point where you have the view which sees them as equal, equal to oneself as well, not better than, I think the root problem of the I is the conceit of I. It says, I am better. It doesn't just say I. It's like in our deepest recesses when we feel super miserable and pitiful, we still think, I got, you know, I'm better when it comes down to it. That conceit of the I, that's so, that's cause of suffering. You know? Gotta get root that out. And that happens whether you're Buddhist or you're Baptist. You go to Baptist camps, those summer schools. I don't know, did anybody raise Baptist? Besides the one person who said they were today. Did you ever go to Baptist camps? She said this. But I read a memoir by a man who really gave the details on camp, you know, and all the things you went through. And then he said, it took him all this, and his son developed his illness and all this. And at the end is this one little line. He said, my problem was that I thought I was better. I went, you know, like after 250 pages, this was what stood out. I was getting all these details on the camps, you know, what you sang and what you da, 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 da. And then his son, and that was so poignant. And then he still said that one little sentence on page 236, I still thought I was better than them all. That's the biggie. So if we don't think we're better than them all, we maybe see each other, we see it as equal, without inferiority, without superiority, not pitying somebody or give them something. That's so hard for us. Well, I'm going to give them something. I'm a good person. Besides, they're kind of bad in a bad way. You know, all that stuff, all that baggage. If we could just do something without expectations. He was holding this, I was listening to a tape the other day, he was being interviewed, and he said, you know, a bodhisattva, they say, gives a gift, and it's a paramita, meaning it's transcendent. English translators say it's transcendent. A bodhisattva gives a gift, and, you know, it's like, And His Holiness said, it's so simple. And Lama Yeshe would have said, that's so simple, dear. You give a gift with some expectation. You know, like, I'm going to give this to you, and I hope you tell someone, so and they'll tell somebody. And somewhere. I don't have to hear it. It'd be better if I hear it, like, a year from now. You know, they'd go all around this whole group that I did that for. His Holiness said, if you give a gift with expectations, that's just a business transaction. Bodhisattvas just give gifts. It's got no conditions attached. That's what makes it transcendent. Wouldn't it be great if we could act like that? So that was a little off equality, but it's connected. Thank you. Hope everyone has a wonderful sleep.
Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org. tibetanpodcast.org/donate.